considered his greater career achievement. He said that he taught foreign journalists to spell Andrzej. That's the second stage, you know. To pronounce it is easier. Okay, so I would like to tell you about some theoretical issues related to experiments searching for new physics with muons, and with an emphasis on various open theoretical questions, just in case someone would like to do something in three dimensions. But I will not talk only about muons. I will also talk a little bit about electrons, in part to complement it and in part to contrast, and you will see that there are interesting connections. So there are at least three promising directions in this type of low energy new physics searches. There are searches involving anomalous magnetic moments, both for the muon and the electron. There are electric dipole moments. At present, they are best searched with electrons. And then there are transitions between muons and the electron, like involving lepton flavor violation, and both involving dipole-type transitions and non-dipole related to muon-electron conversion. So I will talk about these three directions, starting with G minus 2, so the anomalous magnetic moment. As you know, there has been this long-standing, now more than decade, for more than a decade, there is this discrepancy between the experimental result and that exceeds the standard model prediction by about twice the electroweak contribution. So it's a big discrepancy. Its statistical significance is also fairly large, depending on who you talk to, between 3 and 4 sigma. But this absolute value of this effect, exceeding the electroweak contribution, that's somewhat puzzling. So if you compare this with, so we can express this discrepancy that is dimensionless here in terms of a dipole moment, multiplying it by the charge of the muon and dividing by twice the mass, so the kind of the muon version of Bohr magneton, and the resulting dipole moment is 3 × 10⁻²² E times centimeter. And if we compare this with bounds coming from other types of measurements, for example, the mu to E gamma search in Paul Scherrer Institute in Switzerland, there is a new bound that is 5 orders of magnitude smaller. And then there is a very new result on the electron EDM, electric dipole moment. In the same units, it is more than 6 orders of magnitude smaller. So we see that this G minus 2, if we say that this discrepancy is due to new physics, is a huge effect. 5 or 6 or more orders of magnitude larger than other new physics bounds. Of course, one can say, well, these observables have lepton flavor or CP type of suppression, but it is not obvious that any new physics will have those effects really strongly suppressed. So there are natural mechanisms why they are suppressing the standard model. It's not obvious that they certainly don't universally translate into new physics models. So there is this big puzzle, and some people are skeptical about this really being new physics. So it's very important to find ways to check this result. And there are various efforts, of course. So I think that for me, the most interesting type of efforts is looking for kind of nail sticking out somewhere in this experimental apparatus in Brookhaven. The problem is that it has been taken apart now. So it's being moved to Fermilab with the intention of running this experiment again using the same principle, but increasing the the sensitivity by about a factor of 4 or 5. So this is the envisioned progress. So this is the present experimental error, uncertainty, and this is the future experimental planned uncertainty at Fermilab. Using the same principle of the experiment, in fact, the same magnet, it has been just a year ago transported in an adventurous sea trip from Brookhaven to Fermilab through Mississippi, etc.
But are people really skeptical about the experimental result, or I thought they're more skeptical about the theoretical result?
I'm talking about, you know, from a theoretical point of view, so.
But if you have uncertainties in the theories that are as large as your point error bars, how will it help to measure it better?
Well, you probably mean hadronic uncertainty. Yeah. So that's, of course, the standard suspect. But it's hard to imagine that it would close this gap. So you see, this is the theoretical prediction. There are some plans to decrease this hadronic uncertainty by the time that Fermilab runs with a combination of lattice and new experimental input for the vacuum polarization. But it is, you know, it has been now beaten for so many years that it's hard to imagine that there is really a large effect hidden in the hadronic contribution that would close this gap. So we have an direct experimental input that allows us to evaluate the vacuum polarization, and then there is this much smaller contribution from light by light scattering that is more than a factor of 2 smaller than the discrepancy, the whole contribution. So the uncertainty is really way smaller. And this light by light has been evaluated in a variety of more or less well-motivated theoretical models, and there are simply no evaluations that would give this a large effect. One very promising development is that there is a new experimental concept in Japan that is very different from this method. I will discuss this in the next slide. And also another interesting new player, that's a new development, is trying to use the electron G-2. And I will discuss that as well, to how far electron G-2 is from probing this new physics. So what is this Japanese approach? The basic idea of the Fermilab Brookhaven approach was to run with high energy muons at so-called magic momentum of 3.1 GeV. At this particular momentum, the spin of the muon is not sensitive to the electric field. So one can use electric field to focus muons, and to the first approximation at least, there is no sensitivity. This electric field does not cause an additional muon precession. Now, the Japanese want to go to about a factor of 10 lower energy, so use low energy momentum, which allows them to use a much smaller magnet. The size of the Brookhaven apparatus is about the size of this room. So it is a ring with a diameter of about 14 meters. And this diameter, okay, or the radius, scales like the relativistic gamma, so the time dilation factor, over the magnetic field. Now, if we decrease the energy by a factor of 10 and increase the magnetic field, one can decrease the radius from 7 meters to about a foot. What is important is that the muons cannot now be in contact with any electric field, so they cannot be focused electrically. And there is a new that's, I think, the most challenging part of this experiment is to develop a source of muons that will not require focusing. They will be, as one says, ultra cold. So they will be produced with very low transverse momentum, with very low momentum period, and then accelerated to this 300 MeV, and very strong and precisely controlled magnetic field. Now, one drawback additional drawback of going to this low momentum is that muons have this smaller time dilation factor, so they live a factor of 10 shorter, and one needs a larger statistics of muons. So this source has to be very efficient. By the way, this original, the so-called magic gamma that leads to this 3.1 GeV, is itself related to G minus 2. It is the square root of the inverse of this, to a good approximation of the G minus 2 result by Schwinger, alpha over 2 pi. Okay, so that's given up. One has to use more muons to compensate for the shorter lifetime. But the advantage is that there are almost, it is much easier to control this magnetic field. It's not some huge apparatus where one has to take literally train trips to measure the magnetic field. So in this original Brookhaven experiment and in Fermilab, there is a train that runs through the ring inside the tube with an NMR probe to monitor the magnetic field. And instead, the Japanese will have a kind of a medical type of a magnet with a very strong field. And will it will be almost a tabletop experiment with much better control. Jerry Gabrielse has an even more radical idea to use trap muons, so no momentum at all, almost. But he's talking about a magnet that would have 20, or even he's talking about a 40 Tesla magnet to trap muons. And of course, he's an expert now in various trapping experiments. But it is kind of a futuristic, at present, a science fiction type of an approach. The greatest challenge there is that there is no relativistic enhancement of the muon lifetime at all. So one needs huge statistics. Great. So that's the experimental approach. This is the way to check whether there isn't some experimental problem in from Brookhaven. So I think that the Fermilab experiment should have results by the end of the decade, and the JPARC experiment I think will take a little bit longer, but it's not completely clear. It's interesting. Triumph Group is working on the development of this muon source, and they say they have already very good results. So who knows? They don't have to build this huge apparatus. But they still have to make some breakthroughs. I think looking from now, they will happen on a similar time scale. Okay, so how about using this G minus 2 of the electron? It is measured to a much higher precision. So the relative error is relative error is 25 times 10 to minus 11. That's almost four orders of magnitude better than the muon. The problem is that cannot be used directly to search for new physics, because this is the best source of the fine structure constant. And most of the theoretical prediction consists of the QED contribution. So if we look at the breakdown of G minus 2, the QED contribution is about 10 to minus 3. And hadronic contribution is about 6 times 10 to minus 8. Okay, so there is this almost five orders of magnitude difference between something before something heavier starts showing up. And we want to have, of course, even heavier access to heavier things than pions. So one needs to have this huge overhead of QED contribution under perfect control. So the key to the theory of G minus 2 is a very high accuracy determination of alpha. At present, it comes from this G minus 2 of the electron itself, combination of this experiment. And in fact, when the experiment was announced, the result was announced in 2008, its accuracy exceeded the accuracy of the theory. So the theory error was dominating in the determination of alpha. But since then, Kinoshita and collaborators have improved 4 and 5 loop diagrams, and now they have a factor of 4 better accuracy. Now, so how can one use G minus 2 of the electron to check G minus 2 of the muon? if we expect that there is a new physics that gives this discrepancy in G minus 2, it typically scales like the square of the electron or the muon mass. I mean, like the square of the lepton mass for the lepton G minus 2. Therefore, the effect is relatively suppressed by 43,000 in the electron G minus 2. So, if we see an effect that is now this discrepancy between the experiment and the theory in the muon, about 300 times 10 to minus 11, if we divide this by 43,000, we want to see effects in the electron G minus 2 on the order of 7 times 10 to minus 14, which means the relative uncertainty, remember that the leading contribution, QED contribution, is 10 to minus 3. So this absolute effect corresponds to the relative uncertainty of 7 times 10 to minus 11. And scales like alpha. So we need alpha to better than 7 times 10 to minus 11. And we need a measurement of the electron G minus 2 to better than 7 times 10 to minus 11. Which means on the experimental side, an improvement of only a factor of 4. Okay, so I mean only. It's not a trivial thing, but it is definitely in the cards. They have the group at Harvard is actively working on the new apparatus, and it will, if everything goes as planned, it will for sure provide more than a factor of 4 improvement. But it's less obvious that we will have alpha with this matching accuracy, and the best bet is from atomic spectroscopy. So there is this quantity called Rydberg, which is related to the binding energy of the hydrogen 13.6 electron volt, although as described here, it has the dimension of inverse length. Anyway, it's a combination of the electron mass, c, that's the speed of light, which is an integer, it's known exactly at present, alpha, which we eventually want to get out of this Rydberg, and the Planck constant. So in other words, to use Rydberg, we need this ratio of the electron to Planck constant. And fortunately, we have alpha square, so we need it to this, since we need alpha to precision of 7 times 10 to minus 11, alpha square to precision of 14. Now let's look at these, so we solve this equation for alpha. We have Rydberg, and I've introduced here two auxiliary variables, so the atomic mass scale, that's the 12th of the carbon 12 atom mass, and some mass of something else. The point is that it is hard to measure the ratio of the electron to Planck constant mass because of various things, including the charge of the electron. But it's useful to introduce these auxiliary variables and measure these ratios separately. Now, first of all, let's look at the various uncertainties, beginning with the Rydberg. On paper, Rydberg is known to 7 times 10 to minus 12. Not quite for sure right now, because there are those doubts because of the proton radius. So as you know, there are those discrepancies between the determination of the proton radius from hydrogen spectroscopy and from muonic hydrogen spectroscopy. Very puzzling. And one possible solution is that the hydrogen experiments were incorrect and the Rydberg will have to shift. But for our purposes, this does not affect us at this level of precision. So we are not that sensitive yet here. Okay, so Rydberg we can take for granted. Now, the electron in atomic units, electron mass in atomic units, is almost known to the right precision, roughly 8 times 10 to minus 11. So it's it's already there, because we this is for alpha square. So it is already there since a few months. A Nature paper based on work by Mainz Heidelberg group. I will mention this in more detail in a second, because there is some theory that we provided for it that is kind of cute. And and it is now useful to use rubidium or helium for this X atom. And It is roughly there for rubidium. It's possibly better for helium. But rubidium is at present the best chance to improve this final quantity. That's the main stumbling block. This is the missing part. It's still off by its accuracy has to be increased by a factor of 10. And there is a lot of experimental effort to and these are very beautiful experiments using some very intricate quantum mechanics. But the basic idea is such that one shines a photon, excites the rubidium atom, so the rubidium absorbs this photon and then starts moving to the right. And then, from time to time, it re-emits this photon in this backward direction and then starts moving even more to the right. Just by measuring the shift of the energy of the photon, one gets the ratio of the mass to the Planck constant. And the reason for this is that, of course, the Planck constant enters the momentum and therefore the kinetic energy, and there is a mismatch of powers because the photon is relativistic and rubidium atom is very non-relativistic here. So one depends on the first power of the momentum, therefore first power of the Planck constant, the other on the square. And the bottom line is one extracts the ratio of the Planck constant to the mass. And work is in progress to improve this by a factor of 10, but these are very hard experiments, but by some of the best experimenters, including various Nobel laureates in Stanford and Paris. Okay, so anyway, this is the value of this rubidium source of the alpha. And this is the second best determination of the fine structure constant. We hope it will be improved, and then one can really use this electron G minus 2. Now, I wanted to... You can think, I think, about it as a kind of a heavier version of hydrogen, and which has a simple, relatively simple spectroscopy. It's also very well known. So it's, you know, people.
You also know how to cool it very well. Mm-hmm. Those experiments
are has the right cooling transitions, and yeah. Now, here I just would like to advertise a piece of theory that we did in Alberta related to G minus 2, but to the G minus 2 of a bound electron. The point is that when one measures this quantity, the electron mass in units of the atomic mass, in order to do this, spectroscopy of an electron trapped in a Penning trap is utilized. So various frequencies of the magnetron and cyclotron motion and the Larmor spin precession frequency are measured in a Penning trap. And in the past, so like 30 years ago, the best determination was coming from a free electron trapped in the Penning trap, until the accuracy was so high that the main systematic uncertainty was coming from the thermal motion of the electron in a cryogenic trap. So you can imagine what sensitivity we are talking about for these mass measurements, that we have a 4 Kelvin black body radiation in this trap, and this is in equilibrium with the electron. The electron gets some velocity because of these black body photons, and at 4 Kelvin, this leads to the relativistic shift of the mass. So instead of dealing now with a free electron, one measures the same frequencies with an electron bound to the carbon nucleus. So it's basically a carbon atom, five-fold ionized. So it has just one, it's hydrogen-like carbon ion. And as a result, it is, I don't know, tens of thousands times heavier than the electron itself. And correspondingly, at the same temperature, moves that much slower. And the relativistic shift of the mass is completely negligible. But the problem is that now the frequencies are determined by the properties of a bound electron. For example, the Larmor frequency, so the only magnetic interaction of such an ion is due to the electron because carbon 12 is spinless. But the G factor of the electron is a bit modified by the interaction with the Coulomb field. And this modification was actually first calculated by Gregory Bright in 1928. But this modification of the G factor, as you know, Schwinger did this first calculation of the one loop of the one loop modification of G in 1948, so 20 years later. And Bright was using the, you know, completely fresh Dirac equation. It had just been formulated. Bright added the magnetic field of the nucleus and calculated how this great success of Dirac, G equal 2, changes because of the binding.
Right. And that's a final calculation where Schwinger's minus 2x final calculation is Schwinger's greatness was that that piece alone is finite and the other combinations are infinite.
Absolutely true, yes. Nevertheless, you know, one thing.
But 20 years was meaningful 20 years. There wasn't people working on it.
Well, it's not that people had been working on it for 20 years, but you know, since you mentioned this comparison, Schwinger versus Bright, Bright did this whole line. So he had an exact result in Z alpha. It is a nice square root, I don't know, 3 minus 2 square root 1 minus Z alpha square. And Schwinger calculated this term, alpha over pi. And then when he had his doctoral student, he said, look, this guy Bright did it to all orders in Z alpha. Now you do it to all orders in alpha. And
who was the student?
Sommerfeld, who was your predecessor at Yale, right? Yeah, so he in the eyes of Schwinger, he was a complete failure. He only computed this term, the next term in the expansion. And in fact, if you read Schwinger's Particle Sources and Fields, he makes fun of Sommerfeld. he still got tenure at Yale. But now look, we are just talking about the edges of this expansion, which is in two parameters, Z alpha and alpha. But there are, of course, mixed terms. So it's the real interesting question is what happens when we have both self-interaction and the external Coulomb field? And what happens are those mixed terms. So there is alpha times Z alpha square, alpha times Z alpha to the fourth, and OK, Z alpha square is actually a purely kinematic effect. And as you see, it's always Z alpha square over 6, except for this first line. But as soon as we have self-interaction, it's relatively easy to get, and it's known to all orders. But this real, what I would say, real one-loop calculation was surprisingly challenging. And even though people tried for some time, it was completed numerically in 1999, and then analytically already in 2000 something. I actually got into this field a bit later, and we worked with Krzysztof Pachucki and other collaborators on the two-loop calculation. And at present, so that's worked out now, and at present, because the experimenters with this latest result of this year are catching up in accuracy, we are trying now to get this Z alpha to the fifth, which is something very mysterious. We've already spent actually a few years trying to do this, and it turns out to be not so easy. It's interesting because there are similar... I should mention one thing, that numerically, one knows this whole line now to all orders in Z alpha, and in fact, one knows it better for large Z alpha than for small, thanks to Shabayev in St. Petersburg and his collaborators, Yerokhin and others. But it doesn't seem to be, it cannot easily be extended to two loops and more. So one needs a combination of analytical and numerical methods. But these are, I actually wasn't aware of this, that one can do those calculations to all or numerically, that one can do fairly advanced loop calculations with exact Coulomb propagators. So it's interesting that one can do those calculations for bound electrons. And the same type of work is also needed for muonium spectroscopy. That's important for a little known contribution to muon G-2 experiments, where one needs the ratio of the muon and proton magnetic moments for the determinations of the magnetic field. So the new experiments in Fermilab and Japan will require this better knowledge of the muon magnetic moment to proton magnetic moment ratio, and that requires those binding corrections to in that spectroscopy. And just to finish this G-2 part, I would like to tell you about another source of alpha that probably you have not heard about that comes also from bound states, but in heavy ions, so like lead, for example. The idea is that one can do those experimental measurements with those ions in penning traps. Germans, in particular, have perfected this technology, and a collaboration of Mainz and Heidelberg, and for heavier ions, Darmstadt, can do those measurements with some phenomenal accuracy. But of course, so as you remember, the G factor, thanks to Bright, we know that it is, to a good approximation, 2 minus some z alpha square. Now, if we measure G, we can extract alpha from this equation. And the error in alpha looks like a combination of the experimental and the theoretical errors divided by alpha z square. So the larger z, if these numbers are fixed, the better accuracy one can get on alpha. Now, it does. I think since this idea was proposed a few years ago, it now doesn't look that one can really be competitive for these new physics type of searches, but it's still interesting that one can kind of match the accuracy of present determination of alpha, maybe. But it requires still a lot of experimental and theoretical work. But the crucial thing is that there is, of course, sensitivity to the nuclear structure. And the idea to overcome this is to measure two types of atoms, hydrogen-like lead and boron-like. So boron has z equal 5. We have 5 electrons around lead. We have the 1s and 2s orbitals filled, and this electron is in a p orbital. So we have one s type atom and one p type atom. One can combine these two results in such a way, the experimental results, that there is still some sensitivity to z alpha square, but that the most of the sensitivity to the nuclear structure vanishes. So that's the idea how one can use even very complicated nuclei to get very precise numbers.
I don't know, so how can you get nuclear sensitivity with a p orbital?
What's wrong about the p orbital?
Well, it doesn't overlap with the orbital.
With a point like,
yeah.
With a point like nucleus.
Well, even if it's not point like, then you're reduced by a factor of the size of the atom divided by the nucleus.
Yeah, which is not such a killer. And also, what you are saying is really exactly true in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, but the p orbital actually has an, you know, the Dirac wave function does have an overlap with the nucleus. But you are absolutely right. There is a price to pay, and it is roughly like a power of alpha. Uh-huh. Yeah, which is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, why did it not, for example, didn't hyperfine levels of the
hydrogen-like lead? So I'm not 100% sure, frankly speaking, but I believe that there the sensitivity is very different to the things like the magnetic moment distribution in lead. And so I think that it is better to stick to one observable. Very briefly, I would like to tell you about the electric dipole moment, since this leads to such a fantastic sensitivity in this new physics search. As you know, of course, this is an T or CP violating observable. If we reverse the direction of time, the spin of the electron reverses the direction, but the dipole moment is not affected by that. The charge distribution is that is not affected by the time reversal. So we see that the observable at one point is parallel to the spin in the other. It's anti-parallel, and therefore the world looks different on a normal movie and on a movie played backward. Okay, and so it's a fantastic way to search for new physics, and many groups are trying. Now, in 2006, so many years ago, I had to give some review talk that included this electric dipole moment, and I interviewed for the purposes of that talk all experimenters I could contact. And they told me that, so at that time, the bound that existed was from an experiment by Eugene Cummings in Berkeley, and they wanted to beat it. That bound was already 5 years old by then. And so it was 2006, two groups told me, or one, that they would be done by 2007, the group in London. Then the Yale group claimed that they would be there soon afterwards. And there were various optimistic scenarios by 2009, and then slightly after 2009. Now, so there were various routes using atoms, molecules, and even solid state. Atoms was kind of the standard way. Molecules was an emerging new player that had not yet yielded any results. And a kind of a futuristic approach was using macroscopic systems in solid state. Now, in 2010, Maxim had to give a similar talk. And this is a slide taken from his talk. This is Dave DeMille from Yale. The point was that by 2010, there was not a single new result experimental. But fortunately, there is some recent great progress. So in 2011, Maxim had bad luck. He was before his time. But just after Maxim's talk, there was an announcement of this new result. That this is, by the way, if we look go back here, this is this group. So at Heinz was done by 2011.
Why is it written like that?
Like what?
The exponent, just to be more dramatic. Why is it 10 times 10 to the minus 38? It's really from 1.6 to 105. It's so dramatic that I don't know. You know?
Look, that it does look somewhat better. But no, what, yeah, so, yeah, the trend persists, look. This year there is the new result, and now Dave DeMille does play a role, but it's interestingly not the result he was anticipating in 2006. So at that time he was working with lead oxide that turned out to just not be feasible. This is thorium oxide. So it's the first time the new development in this field that there is a collaboration that spans not only several faculty members, but also two universities. This is becoming a kind of big science type of an effort. And interestingly, you see that these are high profile works published in Nature and Science, and they always refer to the shape of the electron. So I'm just wondering what will happen once they do discover the electric dipole moment. Because how will they translate this into the shape of the electron? One analogy, I think, is whether the dipole moment is parallel or anti-parallel to the spin. But there are certain parallels with this 18th century dispute about which gravitation theory is right. Because Descartes was saying that, you know, the fact that we stick to the Earth is due to the push rather than pull, that there are those vortices that push on us. And that, of course, would lead to the cucumber type of shape of the Earth. And it became a big political issue because this was the French theory. And the British theory by Newton was saying that because of the centrifugal force, that the pull of the gravity would not be enough to make the Earth spherical and that it would be flattened. You know who settled this dispute? Maupertuis was one of the people. The point was, the experimental approach was to send people to the far north and to around the equator and compare by how much the angle at which we see the Polaris, for example, changes as we move, say, 10 kilometers, which is not that easy, you know, in the far north, for example. And Maupertuis figured out, so the French expedition figured out that the British theory was right. So when they returned to Paris, they had political trouble. And eventually, Maupertuis had to leave France and went to Berlin. And recently, some prominent experimenters who tried to measure EDM have been leaving United States for other reasons. But Yannis Semmertsidis, for example, went to Korea, where he hopes that he can do something within his lifetime. Okay, so when will we get to the real determination of some non-zero result? So there are many very promising approaches. Definitely,
yes. Can I ask, what is the skeletal population? It's 36 or quite
something like that. You know, I don't exactly remember, but it is off the scale completely.
Yeah, so what do you mean by getting there? Where assuming there is something.
Yes. So, well, you see, okay, let's maybe skip this. There is experimental progress expected. But I would like to show you this historical comparison of results going back to the pioneering years of particle physics. So here, 1950s still, and you see it's interesting that these curves, that these plots proceed in those kind of L-like shapes. So there is some new idea, and then it matures and flattens here again, and yes, up to here. And then these two latest results are from London and Harvard using molecules. So molecules are the big new development. It's also interesting that most of these results are from Comin's group. I was asking people why there has been this gap of about 10 years here, and they told me that, well, you have to look earlier here. Around this time, Comin's retired. And before he did, the field was so dominated by his group that other people didn't want to enter because they thought before they catch up, he would have a new result and beat them anyway. So he retired, and then many new people entered the field and started new measurements. And now there is this new idea, it is working, and it is very promising in the sense that it is at present limited mainly by the number of those molecules that one can produce. And that certainly can be overcome and improved. But there are also opportunities for theories. That's one of the things that one can do, namely, even if the electric dipole moment of the molecule is discovered, it has still to be translated into the new physics mechanism that is underlying it. The connection between even the naked electron dipole moment and this molecular dipole moment is very non-trivial, and the enhancement, so-called enhancement factors.
Can I ask you a question? I heard about Wagner currents, and there was some chemistry involved in all of this that involved the electric fields inside the molecule.
Yes.
I asked him how well do they actually know that, and he wasn't sure.
Yeah, so I think nobody is sure at present because there are published papers that differ by a factor of a few, but not by orders of magnitude. So it is.
I think what Eric is asking: are we competing against chemists, or are we competing against chemistry?
Well, remember that in this type of chemistry, Nobel prizes are awarded to physicists who come up with. calculational method. I think it's just a few body physics where you have to understand this molecule fairly well. But yeah, I think it is an opportunity for quantum chemical physicists, so to say.
So how would you continue this curve?
I think it will continue. It will. It's a very new field that is far from maturing. So if you look at their projections, they are at 10 to minus 28 now. 10 to minus 20, just below 10 to minus 28. People use this ACME as a new unit. And so they refer that they will beat ACME. For example, Eric Cornell plans to beat ACME in the near future, and his ultimate goal is below another order of magnitude. But ACME itself says that they can go well below 10 to minus 30. I mean, well below is a factor of few. And these quantum chemistry calculations are good enough to identify the best molecules, but not to do a precision determination of this new physics contribution. Okay, so in the last few minutes, I would like to... How much time do you have? Okay. So in the last few minutes, I just would like to tell you about lepton flavor violation. Again, here is a historical overview, another kind of L-type shape. And there are, as you see, two lines, like more or less like in the stellar evolution plots. There is the main sequence, and the main sequence is muons. Various decays of the muon, for example, mu to e gamma was in fact the first decay that people were searching for after muon was identified around 1948. They thought it was just an excited electron and it would emit a photon and become an electron. That didn't materialize, and people thought that there must be a reason, and that led to the two neutrino hypothesis and became the first place where this concept of generations was formulated, and therefore that was really the cornerstone of the standard model. In addition to mu to e gamma, people were soon looking for the process of muon becoming an electron without emitting a photon. Near the nucleus, such the momentum can be taken up by the nucleus, and one can have this very clean mu to e conversion. And in addition, people are looking also for the decay of the muon into three electrons. So these two processes have analogies in B physics. We know the B quark decay into C and gamma, and B into three leptons. B2s gamma and B2s and two electrons. Now the other lepton flavor violation bounds come, for example, from B physics and from tau, but they are just not really competitive in most models. Of course, one can say tau is third generation. Anyway, I will not talk about tau. Now, the current best limit on any exotic dipole moment comes from these measurements on mu to e gamma, but there are these plans both to improve mu to e gamma and also to improve mu to three electrons and to dramatically improve the conversion. So what is special about these decays? The point is that that as you see, we have not found any really convincing evidence of new physics in dipole moments, except for this muon g minus 2, which is a bit questionable. But these processes are sensitive not only to the dipole-like transition, but also to other kind of monopole type of transition broader spectrum of operators, as well as dipoles. So these are very well motivated processes, and the neat thing about why they can go to this huge sensitivity is that they have a simpler experimental signature, so less danger of this accidental background from photon coming from one muon and the electron coming from the other. They claim they are almost background free. They can measure huge numbers of muons at the same time because they avoid accidental background. And it turns out there is actually one source of background, namely where the muon undergoes the normal decay in the field of the nucleus. So unlike in the standard model free muon decay, the electron can become very energetic. Let's have a look at the spectrum. In fact, it has been measured. This bound muon decay has been measured by also in Canada by Twist. This is a slide taken from their presentation 5 years ago. So here we have a spectrum of electrons coming from the muon decay. The red line is the positively charged muon that does not bound to an atom, and it is more or less like the free muon decay. So it ends at half the muon mass. The maximum energy of the emitted electron is half the muon mass, because the other half of the muon mass has to be used by the neutrinos to balance the momentum. Electron in one direction, two neutrinos in the other. That's the way to get the highest energy to the electron. Now, for the mu minus in matter, the measured result extends beyond this half of the muon mass because of the presence of the nucleus. It can take up the momentum without taking much of the energy. Neutrinos can be very soft. And the black line that goes through most of these points is the best theory prediction, but it differs from the experiment both in this high energy and in the extreme low energy region. So there is this residuals plotted here, and they said that there is this need to include radiative corrections that were not known for the free, for the bound muon decay. And this is what we recently provided. So there is this similar challenge like with this G factor of the bound electron that I mentioned earlier, where we have both the loop from radiative corrections and the interaction with the Coulomb field. The fact that we used to solve this is that the binding is weak, and one can use it as a kind of an expansion parameter, but both the muon and the electron around the decay vertex are nearly on shell. So one can write down certain factorization formula where we have just a free muon decay weighted by the muon wave function, and also one has to take into account the electron interaction in the final state. So the formula we came up with has this factorization form where the neat thing is that we use just the free muon decay spectrum that already has a lot of radiative corrections up to even second order alpha square. They are known. But we have to take this free muon spectrum at a different energy than is observed in the end. There is a certain shift due to various reasons. And there is a weighting function here called the shape function. This is our main achievement here, that we calculated this function. This shape function was introduced already 10 years ago in QCD in the context of B2S gamma, as you said, where however, in QCD, it is not calculable. It can be only extracted from one experiment and then used in another. Here, this function looks almost symmetric here with respect to zero. It's not quite. It is shifted by an amount related to the binding energy, and its spread is related to the Doppler shift, the Doppler smearing because of the Fermi motion of the muon. But it's nice that we now know it analytically, at least in this weak binding case of QED. 10 years ago, when the function was introduced in QCD, the concept was introduced in QCD, Schiffman mentioned in one of his lectures that he can't understand why it took so long to introduce this formalism to heavy mesons, because it had been already known in deep inelastic scattering a decade earlier. Well, we kind of asked the same question, why it took another 10 years to finally use it in the simplest context of QED. But anyway, it is now known, and we get a very beautiful agreement here. So here is this low energy region where our prediction is this red curve. It really goes through the data, and the older theoretical prediction is a solid line here. And we also improve in the high energy region, although there is this dip, which statistically, actually, the quality of this fit is horrible. But so we have improved this chi-square significance by a factor of 3, from about 9 to 3. But chi-square of 3 per degree of freedom, but there are many degrees of freedom here, and it is a really bad fit still. But we think that the only fair explanation at present is that the experimental errors are simply underestimated. And so we tried to contact experimenters. They said it was some graduate student who assigned these errors. We don't know how he did it. And he Now, the last thing, I'm afraid I'm going over time, but I just would like to tell you something about the rest of the spectrum here. So because even though it's been measured only up to here, the spectrum actually extends to the end of, to the full muon mass. And, well, does one need radiative corrections to this spectrum? One could say, well, it does seem to be a bit suppressed, so who cares? Well, it turns out that That's where this muon to electron conversion expects their signal, and since they are going to this incredible sensitivity of 10 to minus 17 or 10 to minus 18, they are actually most worried about this spectrum. So we are now working out the radiative corrections. This spectrum in this bound decay seems to be considered by people as a bit mysterious. So we are very proud that at least we do understand a qualitative mechanism how these electrons end up here in the first place in terms of Feynman diagrams. There are just two diagrams responsible for it. One can treat the muon and electron basically as free and just exchange one hard photon either between the, that gives a kick to the electron or gives a good pull to the muon and moves the spectrum to this. This is a very highly virtual photon, so one doesn't need to worry about it. Basically carries all the momentum of 105 MeV and no energy, so that the electron ends up with this high energy. And yeah, I just would like to mention that we are also working on these radiative corrections for the free muon lifetime. For the first time, we are for any particle decay, we are trying to do it at alpha cube level, mainly for Guinness Book of Record type of motivation, although we expect that it might shift the Fermi constant a little bit. But we think we found a cute and non-intuitive method of doing this by using an expansion around the limit where the muon and the electron have the same mass. They don't, of course, but the expansion has some magical mathematical properties, converges incredibly, and for example, at two-loop level, alpha square, this is the exact result, this red here, and this blue is the result of the expansion of just, I think, 6 terms of this expansion gives this perfect agreement. So we have already a few terms of the expansion at alpha cube, mainly thanks to Matt Dowling, a former graduate student in Alberta. He moved on as a postdoc to Germany, and they didn't let him do this calculation on their computer unless he would pay for electricity. So it gives you an idea about the scale. So he has been using our Alberta computer and has burned through 6 hard drives. It's quite something. And these are really large-scale calculations. So, thank you very much for your attention, and I hope I've convinced you that there are some interesting theoretical problems to be solved. Thanks.
So we already had quite a few questions, but if there's more, and if, by the way, we're also taking Andrei to dinner tonight, so if you want dinner, stick around. And questions?
What time?
6:30.
Yeah. Could you please let us know if we're coming, because we're doing a family style and we have to give them the numbers a couple hours.
But any questions? We also have Andrei for the rest of the week, so.
Thanks a lot.
So, Eric, do you think you can make it for dinner? Anyone else?
Yeah. Maybe 6:30.
6:30 is better. Yeah. We have. Are you staying?
No, yeah. I think we have. Are there specials for the dinner downstairs?
I think we have 6 people.
What
I mean is that it's just your example, there is no problem with the calculation.
Against the chair, it's
what else you put?
That's the first time.
Pardon me?
That's the first time I put
more.
I mean, it's not.
Yeah, I think.